Fine. I'm going to tell you today about work that I've been doing with my group for many years, and it's really a different reformulation of quantum mechanics. I was led to do this by wondering about the very strange properties of quantum systems. As you know, what quantum mechanics reveals about the world is that the world behaves in a non-deterministic way. In classical physics, if we have two particles that start at exactly the same state and they have the same environment, they will behave in the future exactly the same way. But in quantum mechanics, we have two atoms that are exactly identical, they are excited, and one of them emits a photon after 1 minute, and the other emits a photon after 1 hour. There was absolutely no difference between them. So this is very strange. Nature behaved in a capricious way. For no reason at all, one atom decides to emit the photon after 1 second, and the other decides to emit the photon after 1 minute or 1 hour. Why should nature behave this way? You know that Einstein was one of the fathers of quantum mechanics. First, he was so disturbed by this situation that he coined the phrase, "I don't believe that God plays dice." Namely, I don't believe that nature throws a coin to decide at what time the atom will emit the photon. Doesn't make sense. I will, in my work, I was actually led to rephrase Einstein's statement and to ask the question, why does God play dice? What does nature gain from this seemingly capricious behavior? And if we find the reason for this, then it will not be capricious anymore. There will be a reason for this kind of non-deterministic behavior. And to anticipate what I'm going to tell you, I will show that in fact you can reformulate quantum mechanics and find a new description that says that there was indeed a difference between these two atoms at the beginning, but we can find this difference only later in the future. No experiments in the past can tell us that these atoms are different, but another experiment that we'll do in the future will find out that indeed from the beginning these atoms were different. So let's see how this comes about. Suppose we look at time and we say at some initial time t1, we started with many particles, all of them described initially by exactly the same state. So we're describing a physical ensemble of many particles that all of them were described initially by the same vector, psi. So this is all of them, particle 1 and particle 2 and particle 3, etc. All of them are initially described by the same vector in Hilbert space. They have all exactly the same initial condition. At some later time, t2, we make another measurement, and that measurement now, I measure another property of this particle, and that measurement now finds the different particles, although they all started in the same state, ended up in different states. This one ended up in the state phi 1, this ends at a different state, phi 2, etc. These are different states now. Although all the states are the same, these are different states. So we can now talk about a pre- and post-selected ensemble. The pre-selected ensemble are all the particles starting in exactly the same state. We now divide this ensemble to different sub-ensembles according to which vectors we get at the end. So we have now for each particle a pre- and post-selection. A pre-selection that the particle starts at, say, psi, and a post-selection that the particle ended up in the state phi. And the new thing about quantum mechanics is although all the particles started with the same state psi, they will end up at different state phi if we make a different measurement at the end. And I now want to find out what are the properties of this particle in the time in between. So let's take a special example. We start a particle with state psi. We end the particle at state phi. And now we ask the question, suppose we do a measurement in the middle. What answer will we get for this measurement based on these two boundary conditions? And I emphasize that this question can never be asked in classical physics, because in classical physics, if we start with the same state for two particles, we always end up with the same state. We can't end up with different states. So only in quantum mechanics, we can put two boundary conditions in time. One is due to a result of an experiment in the beginning. Another is due to a result of an experiment in the future. And we ask now properties of this particle at the present. So suppose in the present, I make a measurement of an observable that is described by an operator A. And this observable has, say, discrete number of eigenstates, such that the operator A times An gives us the eigenvalue A times An. And we now ask the question, if we make a measurement of A in the middle, what is the probability to get a given answer An depending on these two boundary conditions? So suppose we want to find out then what is the probability to find in the middle the state An, a particular one of them. So what is the usual description quantum mechanically, how to calculate this probability? Well, I start with the state psi n. I take the time evolution operator from this initial time to the intermediate time t when I make this measurement. So I will put here the time. All of you have the course in quantum mechanics, right? So you understand what I'm talking about. So I take here the time evolution operator, u, that evolves the state psi n for the time t1 to the time t. Then I project it on the state a n. This gives me an amplitude to start with psi n at time t1 and get the state a n at time t. Now I know that I have this state, and I now propagate this state from the intermediate time t to the final time t2 and project it on the final state phi. This calculation will give me an amplitude. Let's call this amplitude Cn. And if I take Cn absolute value square, this gives me the probability to start with psi n, get in the middle the value an, and end up with the state phi, right? Up to now, everything is just completely simple, and the picture is then the following. From this time until the middle, I have the state psi of c. From the middle time until the final time, I have the state an of c. And then from now on, I will have the state phi. This is the usual description that we are so taught in every course in quantum mechanics. Now I do a trivial mathematical change that will have a very important, very dramatic physical consequence. The simple mathematical change, I take this operator U and bring it here. So I will have now U dagger. When I bring it here, I have to change U to U dagger. I will have U dagger of T, T2, x of the state phi. Then I have the state AN. Then I have the state AN multiplied by U times psi. This is psi, not psi n, okay? This gives me exactly the same answer Cn, right? Because I didn't change anything. So I am therefore allowed to calculate all the physical properties in the time in between using this formalism. It's a trivial mathematical change, but see what fantastic difference it does in the pixel that we have. Because what does U dagger phi means? It means that I take the state phi and propagate it backwards in time to the middle time. Because U dagger, if U is e to the minus ihc, then U dagger is e to the ihc, which is the same as e to the minus ih times minus c. That means that U dagger actually propagates that state phi backwards in time to the middle. And I now have a new picture. That tells me that in order to calculate the properties of a particle at intermediate time that I had pre-selected and post-selected, I can describe the situation in the middle by saying I have one wave from the past propagating to the present, and I have another wave propagating back from the future to the present, and I use both of them on equal footing to calculate the properties of the particle at the time in between. Okay? Since it gives me exactly the same predictions of quantum mechanics as ordinary quantum mechanics, it's just a simple reformulation, but it's a different kind of picture. And when you have a different kind of picture, you can be led by it to ask new kinds of questions and discover, in fact, new phenomena, as I will show you, that was people completely missed it because they didn't look at that picture. So I have now an idea that I can describe a quantum system between the two times, the past where I made one condition, and the future where I'm going to make another condition. I didn't even yet decide what condition I will do, but once I decide in the future which measurement I will do, the particle, already the present, somehow knows that I'm going to make this decision and is going to behave in the present according to both information. So if I can show that that other information is relevant for the particle, it gives me a completely new approach to time. Because somehow the quantum particle knows at the present what decision I'm going to make in the future, according to this picture. Now let's see where this picture leads us to. So let's take the simplest quantum system that we know. We start with a spin half particle that has initially the value sigma x is equal to plus 1, the Pauli formalism. And then at time t2, I make a measurement, and I find for this particular particle, the answer sigma y is equal to plus 1. I have a probability half to get this, and a probability half to get the other one, but I'm going to look only in the cases that I found that initially sigma x was equal to plus 1, and finally sigma y was equal to plus 1. And I ask now, what do I know about this particle at the time in between? Assuming that the spin components are constants of the motion, no magnetic field, so I know that this particle all the time has sigma x equal to plus 1. If I go backwards in time, the same particle has all this time also the value sigma y equals to plus 1. This is more than usually we are allowed to say, because usually we say if sigma x was equal to plus 1, all the time up to here, there was only one vector, which was sigma x equal to plus 1, and from now on there will be another vector. But that vector in the usual picture says nothing about the past, but I now say no. Actually, in the present, the particle somehow knew that it must have both the value sigma x equal to plus 1 and the value sigma y equal to plus 1. How am I going to find an experiment that will show me that indeed the particle has both possible values? So, one possibility, I will measure sigma x as the present. Of course, I will find the answer plus 1 because it was the same as in the beginning. If I measure sigma y instead, I know that I can get the values plus 1 or minus 1, and I am going to discard later all the cases where I got minus 1, and that's trivial. Of course, I can throw them away, but I didn't gain anything because they were both there, and I just decided to throw one of them. This is nothing new, okay? But suppose I try to measure sigma x plus sigma y. What does it mean? I measure the spin components in the 45, if this is x and this is y, I measure the spin components in this direction, okay? What should I get? What answer should I get? Should I get the value 2? Because this is 1 and this is 1, so the sum should give me 2, right? If I'm right, I should get the answer 2, but that's impossible. Because if I divide it by square root of 2, this is just a spin component in a given direction. It can be only 1 or minus 1. It can never be square root of 2, right? Huh? So if I am led by my new picture to say, look, I should get this square root of 2, obviously, I'm wrong. So maybe this picture is completely wrong. I've deduced that I should get the answer square root of 2. I know that this answer is nonsense, so maybe I should throw this picture away. But I'm stubborn, I don't give up so easily. So I told myself, what is going on here? Why don't I get the answer 2 for the sum of them, or square root of 2 even if I normalize? So I told myself, okay, when I make a measurement of the spin component in this direction, how do I do it? I introduce here a magnetic field in that direction. Like in Stern-Gerlach experiment, I introduce a nonlinear magnetic field in this direction, and that splits the particle beam to two beams, beams going up sigma x plus sigma y over square root of 2 is equal to plus 1, and the other one is minus 1. But when I do this experiment, I necessarily disturb both vectors, this one and that one, because when I do a measurement in this direction, what happens to this spin? It starts to process. So if I do an experiment here that lasts a finite time, then I try to measure sigma x plus sigma y, I necessarily disturb both information. This experiment will destroy the information that sigma x equals to plus 1. It will also destroy the information the sigma y is equal to plus 1, and therefore there is no reason why I should see that both these things exist, because the measurement exactly destroys what I'm trying to see. So when I thought about it, I started to think about the question, can I find quantum measurements in the quantum theory that don't disturb what I'm trying to see? And I invented a new concept that I called weak measurement. And this is a very important concept, because usually we think that in quantum mechanics, any measurement must disturb the quantum system, right? Let me show you that there is an interesting limit where this is not correct. And I can find measurements that give me information about quantum systems without disturbing any one of them. So here is the question that I'm asking. Suppose somebody tells me I have n spin half particles, and I prepared all of them in a given direction by measuring the spin in that direction. All of them are plus one in some direction, but I'm not telling you which direction it is. It's my task to find in which direction they were prepared. How will I find it? Well, the usual prescription is the following. I have a large number of them. I will choose a subpart of them and measure their spin in each direction. Calculate the average of that spin. So I will find the average of sigma e. Then I will choose another part, big sufficiently big group, measure sigma y. I will find the average of sigma y. Do the same thing for sigma z. If I know the average of sigma e, the average of sigma y, and the average of sigma z, I know in which direction that all of them were prepared. But I pay the penalty that my measurement disturbs all these particles, because when I measure the measurements of sigma e, all these particles don't stay in the direction, they are all disturbed, right? Can I find another experiment that will disturb even a single particle and nevertheless will find in which direction the particles were prepared? The answer is yes. Let me show which this experiment is. So I now want to prove a very interesting theorem. If you have an ensemble of particles that are all described by the same state, so I have the state of the n particles, psi social, is equal to a product of states of individual particles, psi n, all of those states are the same, okay? So this is an ensemble. If I have n such, large n such particles, I want to show that in the limit when n goes to infinity, I can find out exactly what is psi of each particle without disturbing even a single one of them. So this will be a new kind of measurement that gives me information about quantum systems without disturbing them at all. And the reason why this happens is very interesting. Usually we say that any information, if we want to get information about a quantum system, the disturbance must be proportional to the amount of information that we get. So suppose the amount of information that we get from each particle is only epsilon, I'm going to show that the disturbance of each particle goes at epsilon square. And therefore, if epsilon is 1 over n, I collect all this information, I get information 1. But the disturbance goes as 1 over n square, and therefore the disturbance of the limit of each particle will go to 0. That is behind the formalism that we're going to show you now. By the way, stop me with any question that you like in the middle, don't wait to the end. Is there any question up to now that anyone wants to ask? No? Yes, good.
You've written on the board right here, are we assuming that all the...
Sorry?
All the small psi n are the same because they're all in the same state?
They're in the same state for different particles. The n is just the particle n. So maybe I should use the notation psi for particle n, but all these psi are the same to each other. Okay? So like all the spins that I have described before, they're all in the same state. Any other question? Okay, so let me prove now a very beautiful theorem. If I take the operator n total, which I define as the sum of individual particle operator, this is the particle A, the operator A for particle n, and I divide by n, I'm going to show you that this ensemble at the limit when n goes to infinity is an eigenvector of this operator. And therefore I can measure it without disturbing the system. Let me prove it to you. In order to prove it, I want first to show, to give you a very interesting theorem that I'm always surprised that it is never found in any quantum book. And the theorem is the following. If I have an arbitrary operator A in any Hilbert space, an arbitrary vector psi, I know that the product of that A epsilon psi will give me another vector psi prime, right? Okay? I can always write this vector psi prime as the sum of A1 times psi plus A2 times some orthogonal state of psi. Again, A times psi can always be written, it's a new vector of psi prime. Every vector in any Hilbert space, any number of dimensions, can always be written as some part of it that is parallel to psi, and the other part that is orthogonal to psi. That's true in any number of dimensions. Two dimensions is trivial, but it's true in any number. So this is equal to A1 times psi plus A2 times psi orthogonal. Now I want to find out what is A1 and A2. Very surprising result. If I want first of all to find A1, I multiply on this side by psi. So I get psi times A psi is equal to A1 times psi psi. This is normalized, so it's 1. And this gives me 0, because psi times psi is always 0. So I already found that A1 is equal to something that we usually call the average of A in the state psi, right? This is what usually is called the average of A. But now, remember, I'm discussing just a single system, so it has nothing to do with averages. It's just a mathematical property of Hilbert space that this quantity is the amount in psi prime that is still parallel to psi. Nothing to do with statistics. Now, how do I find what is A2? I first of all realize that I can always make A2 real because I'm free to choose any phase on psi orthogonal. I can always make A2 real because if it's a real times e to the I phi, I can absorb the e to the phi here. So I know that A2 is real when I select the phase of psi orthogonal correctly. I multiply now the state A psi by itself. So I take this is really psi prime times psi prime. So when I multiply this by this, I multiply this sum by itself. This will give me A1 square plus A2 square, right? Because the cross product is 0. So this is A1 square plus A2 square. Now, since this is a omission operator, I can bring this here. And I get now psi times A operator square times psi. And this is what we usually call the average of A square, right? Yes? What? This is A, the square of the operator A. This is A operator square. Because if I bound this A to here, it's A square. Huh?
So A is A hermitian?
What?
Is A self-adjoint? Is it hermitian?
A hermitian, because we are discussing the only things that can be measured. Hermitian operator, yes, you're correct. Okay. So I find now that A2 square is equal to the average of the square of A minus A1 square, but this is minus the square of the average. So I find, therefore, that A2 square is the uncertainty of A, what we usually call the uncertainty of A square. So I have now a beautiful theorem, general theorem in quantum mechanics, that if I have just a single vector, it has nothing to do with statistics, I take the operator A and multiply by this single vector, I get A average, so-called A average times psi, plus delta A times psi orthogonal. It's a beautiful general theorem, and it shows that what we call average and uncertainty has also a mathematical meaning that can be associated with a single vector. It has nothing to do with statistics. Okay? This will be very important for what we are going to do now. By the way, has any one of you seen this theorem before? Yes, you've seen it? Where? Sorry?
I studied with Lev Wagner.
Oh, so he learned it from me, so that's not fair. Otherwise, this theorem should be in every book in quantum mechanics. It's such a beautiful general theorem. I'm always surprised that it's not there. Okay, so now let's come back to our question. What happens if I take the sum of an divided by n and multiply it by the ensemble . What happens when I apply this operator to this ensemble? So, since this is a sum, I can look what happens when I apply one of them and then generalize it. So if I take the operator A for particle M and multiply it by this ensemble, this operator will act only on the particle M here, right? And what will it do to particle M? We already know. We know that the operator A for particle M, when it applies to psi for this particle, it will give me the average of A multiplied by the same state plus the orthogonal, the uncertainty of A times some orthogonal state for particle M, right? So therefore I know that the sum of AN divided by N multiplied by the total ensemble will give me two contributions. One contribution that comes from the fact that all the particles left the state unchanged. So I will have n times A average divided by n multiplied by the same ensemble plus a correction that I call delta psi. And I want to show that this delta psi goes to zero. So what is the correction delta psi? Well, remember that when I took the operator AM and multiplied by the ensemble, I got apart from the thing that I kept here, I got a new state, which was the product of N different from M, that all the particles were left unchanged, plus a correction for particle M, which would be it's not plus. This correction will be for particle M, I will have here the orthogonal state. So I will have here the correction due to the thing multiplied by delta A. So when I x with a particular A times the ensemble, it makes a correction delta A, the uncertainty of A, times the ensemble where particle M in the ensemble went to orthogonal state. Okay? Now, the important thing is that each one of these vectors, where either particle M went to orthogonal state or another particle went to orthogonal state, all these states are orthogonal to each other. So therefore, if I take the sum delta A over N, and I take the sum let us call this thing psi social orthogonal M. Psi social orthogonal M is less than part of the ensemble who accepts all the other particles are states, and particle M went to orthogonal states, okay? Just 1 minute. So I will have delta A over N, sum over N going from 1 to N, times psi social orthogonal N. Okay, this is what I call delta psi. Delta psi is made out of all the corrections that each particle went to orthogonal states, each different particle, and I have the sum of all of them multiplied by the same delta A, because it was the same state for different particles, but divided by N. Now we can see that the size of delta psi goes to zero. Because if I take delta psi times delta psi, I get delta A square over N square. And when I take the square of this thing, I get just N times 1. Because these states are all orthogonal to each other. So the product of this by itself gives me just N. So I will have here times N, and therefore it is delta A square divided by N, and it goes to zero when N goes to infinity. So that means that when I have enough particles that are all of them described by the same state, I have a safety in numbers. Each particle is not disturbed at all, and nevertheless, I found information about the state of each particle. For each operator A, I found what is the average of this A for that particle. Okay? And I can do this experiment of many, many A's. And therefore, for example, if I choose for A a projection operator on a particular position X, the average of this projection operator is psi star of X, psi of X. And therefore, since I can measure any finite number of them without disturbing any of the particles, I will find the wave function of all the particles without disturbing any of them at the limit when I have enough of them in the same state. So this is a new kind of measurement that I call width measurement. At the limit, when I have enough particles, I can make measurements without disturbing any one of them and find out information about the state of each one of them. Okay? This is extremely important in what we are going to discuss from now on. I will stop for a minute, let you ask questions. Yes. Oh, okay. Okay. You want to ask a question? Who? You. Okay.
I'm a little confused how you came from that first
about this?
Step. Yeah, first step to the
this?
Next one. Yeah.
I took the operator A for a particular particle M, okay? And action is on the ensemble, which is a product of psi for all the particles being in the same state. This operator acts only on particle M. And what does it do? It does two things on it. Remember, when I act with the operator A for particle M, I act on the state for particle M. It gives me two contributions. A average times the same state plus delta A times an orthogonal state to the same particle, right? Remember this, okay? So, therefore I'm saying what will happen when I act with this of the ensemble? I get, first of all, the average of A, which is the same for all particles, times the same ensemble, plus the uncertainty of A, which is also the same for all particles, the uncertainty of A times the new state. The new state is this ensemble that is the same for all the other particles. For particle M, it's Wenzel's orthogonal state. So it will be delta A, and I will call it, say, psi orthogonal. Well, psi orthogonal, okay, I will have here delta A times the product from N different from M going up to N, from 1 to N. But I have now the product is for all the particles that I did not x on, and for the particle M, instead of getting psi M, I get the vector psi M orthogonal. Right? So far, okay? Now, the important thing is that those vectors, when I look at different M's, are orthogonal to each other. Because either I change particle M to orthogonal states or another. So when I have a sum, now I have to take this divided by N and sum over all of them, right? This is a sum of N vectors that are all orthogonal to each other. So therefore, when I take the square of them, if I have a square of N vectors on orthogonal, it's really just N. Right? For example, psi 1 plus psi 2 square is equal to psi 1 square, which is 1, plus psi 2 square, which is 1. So it gives me 2 rather than 4. Okay? So if I have n of them, the sum will be just n. So I look at this vector and sum all of them and take the absolute, this is what I call delta psi. Take delta psi square, it goes to 0 as 1 over n. Right? So I've shown, therefore, that I can take, if I have enough particles, I can take any operator, single particle operator, and find exactly its average without disturbing any of the particles. If I have enough such averages, I can find all the properties of individual particles without disturbing any one of them. No collapse at all, and see, I found all the information that I want about the quantum system, provided I have safety numbers. I have enough of them, I can find out all their properties, all their quantum properties, without even disturbing one of them. Very important. Any other question?
No,
Yes.
I'm imagining a spin system.
Yeah.
I want to imagine, so then your observable might be measuring the spin in the z direction.
Right.
I'm thinking like this is A, that's A. What does A divided by N look like? Because if I want to measure the spin in the x direction, I might go to a Stern-Gerlach experiment. But if I wanted to measure, is that the same? I don't want it to be the same as just, obviously, but I don't want to disturb my system, so I can't just measure the spin and divide it by N. I've still destroyed it. How can I measure A on N?
In fact, I'm going to answer this question in a few minutes. If you're willing to wait, you will see the answer, okay? So now let's come back. Let us come back to our initial question. I had sigma x equals to plus 1 at the beginning, sigma y is equal to plus 1 at the end. This is time. And I want now to ask what happens if I measure sigma x plus sigma y in the middle, but now I do this experiment weakly. What does it mean? I assume now that I have n particles, that all of them are preselected with sigma x equals to plus 1, and all of them are postselected with sigma y equals to plus 1. This is a very rare experiment because the probability of finding such a pre- and post-selected ensemble is 1/2 to the power n, but I have enough patience, so I will find out eventually the situation. Later I will show you how I can do a practical experiment that I don't have to rely on such a rare experiment. But assume now that I have pre- and post-selected ensemble, that all the particles are initially described by sigma x equals to plus n, and finally described by sigma y equals to plus n. And now I claim that if I take a measuring device, or if I test now in Hamiltonian, where the interaction between a particular measuring device and all this spin system happens at time t, and the interaction was a q that describes the coordinates of the measuring device times the sum of a n, or so in this case the sum of sigma e plus sigma y for particle n, sum over all the particles. So I take a single pointer and let it couple to all the particles at the intermediate time with this kind of coupling. And I divide it by n and multiply it by lambda, where lambda is larger than 1. What does this Hamiltonian tell me? This Hamiltonian tells me that PQ dot, the time derivative of the momentum conjugate to Q, if I look at the Heisman representation, is equal to minus lambda over n, the derivative of h with respect to q. You know pq dot is the minus the h dq, lambda over n times the sum of n equal of sigma x plus sigma y. And now I'm claiming because the interaction with each one of the particles is so weak that it doesn't disturb anything about this particle, so it doesn't disturb the vector that comes from here, it doesn't disturb the vector from comes from there, therefore I must get here the answer 2 lambda, as if each one of the particles contributes the value 2. And that's indeed what happens. So I can find that impossible value provided I do a weak measurement that doesn't disturb both vectors, and I get a new phenomena that each particle in the time in between has both properties of sigma x equals to plus 1, sigma y equals to plus 1, and if I learn how to do a measurement that don't disturb these two vectors, I will find a new kind, a new rich phenomena in quantum mechanics that is connected with weak measurements. And now I come to the answer to your question, how does it happen that when I do weak measurement, I find a value, an impossible value? I find a value that is much bigger than the maximum energy value. I call those eigenvalues that are the results of weak measurements done on pre and post selected particles, the results of those I call weak values. So weak value is a new property that is associated with an operator A, that is an observable, and with pre and post selection, and it turns out that the weak value is equal to psi final times A times psi initial divided by psi final times psi initial. This I define to be A weak. So A weak depends on the thing that I measure A, on the pre-selection and the post-selection, the measurements happen in the time in between, and the product of the two. This new quantity is now a new feature of quantum mechanics that is associated with pre- and post-selection, and every measurement that will be weak enough will find that particular value when you do the experiment. Now let me prove to you that this is really what happened in the limit of weak coupling. So how do I describe a quantum measurement? Usually I say the following. I have a quantum system that is described by psi, and I have a measuring device that is described by a vector phi. I want now to introduce coupling whose transformation, time-dependent transformation U, will have the property that it will shift phi by an amount that depends on what I measure. So von Neumann described this by the following transformation. He said, let me have phi describing a pointer of a measuring device. This pointer has a cause and a q, and a momentum conjugate to its pq. If I write now a time-dependent transformation, which is e to the I, some coefficient that describes the strength of the interaction, times q times the operator A and the operator Q. And I ask what will happen when I apply this operator, translation operator, times the initial state psi and the initial state of the measuring device phi, okay? So the idea is I have a coupling in the Hamiltonian. I have a coupling H interaction, which is G times Q times A. And if I multiply it by delta of C, then this is the time during which this coupling happened. I assume the coupling happened very quickly, so I can neglect all the usual the free Hamiltonian behavior I can neglect because it happened so quickly that the time displacement of that thing is exactly this operator. So when I have, yeah?
Sorry, I got a bit lost. We have a system psi, a measuring device phi,
right.
And this e to the
I g2a,
that's
an evolution. This is what happens when, if I have an Hamiltonian, describe a coupling between the system and the measuring device,
okay.
And the coupling is g times q times a times delta of c. The coupling happens at a given instance of time. Then the time evolution operator is exactly this thing that I wrote here. Okay? Now, what does this do? If psi is a negative space of A, such that A times psi is equal to a particular value A1 times psi, then so psi is the eigenvector A1. Then what happens when I apply this to this? I replace this by A1. And then e to the I g q times the operator A times this. The operator A x on A1 gives me the number A1. So this becomes simply e to the I g q times the number A1 times phi. And what does this thing do to phi? This is a translation operator of the momentum by the value g times a1. So if I start my pointer, I look at the pointer, as the probability of the pointer as a function of pq, suppose this probability is here, then I see that what this does, it shifts the pointer by distance g times the eigenvalue of this thing, okay? Of the thing that I measure. So by looking at the pointer here, looking at what distance, I will know exactly what is the value of A1, right? If I have now another vector with an eigenvalue A2, this will be shifted to another state, another distance will be which will be g times A2. So I can therefore say this is a legitimate measurement because when I look at the pointer, I will see whether it was shifted by this distance or by this distance. This gives me what I'm trying to measure. What happens if I start the state psi with a superposition of different eigenvalues? Then quantum mechanics, the basic axiom of quantum mechanics says I will get one of the answers with a probability that is proportional to the amplitude of this initial vector along this eigenvector, right? You remember, this is the basic axiom of quantum mechanics. Basic axiom of quantum mechanics, if you have an operator A that has a complete set of vectors, eigenvectors, suppose it's discrete. And if I have a set psi, this is a complete set of vectors, so I can therefore expand any psi as the sum of alpha n times this complete set of eigenvectors an. They are orthogonal to each other. Then the basic axiom of quantum mechanics tells you if you make a measurement of A, you will find one of the eigenvalues with a probability that's equal to alpha, absolute value alpha squared. Now I come to the idea of weak measurement. The idea of weak measurement will be the following. I have the initial distribution for the pointer, the probability of PQ as a function of PQ is given to by this. But suppose now that this coupling has such a weak g, such a small g, that the shift by A, which was g times A1, that shift will be very small compared to the uncertainty. So when I apply this thing on my psi, I get the value A1. I multiply, ask what will happen to phi, the shift of phi will be very small compared to the uncertainty, okay? And then I can get interference between different shifts. Instead of being the shifts completely separate from each other, which is the classical cause of measurement, in the quantum measurement, if it's sufficiently weak, and I get a superposition of either one value or another value, I can get new kind of interference. And that new kind of interference gives me the new properties of weak values. Interference of small steps can give me actually a big step. Okay? Let me show you how it works. And let me show you how the weak value comes and that limit. So I ask now, what happens if I have the operator e to the I, g, but now g is very small, times q for the measuring device, times a for the system, and I apply it to the initial state psi for the system, times the initial state phi for the measuring device. Then because this g is very weak, I can assume, I can take just the linear approximation, 1, plus I GQ times A. And if I know that A is bounded and I choose the wave function Q also to be bounded, I know that this is finite. So when G goes to zero, this is a very good approximation. I can neglect all the higher terms, G squared, Q squared, etc. So I now ask what happens if I apply this operator, 1 plus I GQA times psi times phi, and I do a post selection on another state phi. And ask, when I do the post selection on another state phi, what will happen to the measure, not phi, sorry, phi I've used for this. I will use here a lambda, another state lambda. So what happens if I start with the state psi, do this measurement in the middle time, then post select the state lambda, what will happen to the measuring device when I do this post-selection, okay? So I have to calculate the state lambda times 1 plus I GQ times A times the state psi. And the result will be just a function of Q because the A will just disappear now. It will be just a number. And ask what function of Q will be left here. So, I can do that with the following. I can take this product lambda times psi out and multiply it by 1 and plus I g times lambda a psi divided by lambda psi. Right? You see, the lambda psi and the lambda psi here will cancel each other, and it will be left just with this thing, which is exactly the contribution that I need. Okay? So you see here suddenly pops a new number, which comes from pre-selection psi, post-selection lambda, in the middle, acting with A, and I get this new magical number, a very strange number. Sorry?
What
happened
to Q?
Huh? Q. Q is the, the Q I missed you, the Q, sorry, thank you. Good. You're paying attention. Yeah. Okay, now, because, again, this is very small, I can rewrite this thing as e to the I gq times a weak, where a weak is, again, the final state times a times the initial state divided by the product of the final times the initial. And that tells me now that if I look at psi times phi, and I make a weak measurement of A, what will happen to phi is we multiply by e to the I gu times A weak. And therefore, if I look at the pointer, the shift of the pointer will not be, this is the pointer, the probability of PQ is a function of PQ. This operator tells me now that this is shifted not by one of the eigenvalues, but by the weak value. So I've shown now that when I do weak measurements, very weak coupling to the quantum system, the answer that I get is not one of the eigenvalues, but it is this answer. Now let's come back to our friend, which was sigma is plus sigma y. I start with sigma equals to plus 1, end up with sigma y equals to plus 1, and in the middle I look at the operator sigma x plus sigma y, and I want to calculate its weak value. So the weak value is this divided by sigma y equals to plus 1 times sigma x equals to plus 1. And now, observe that sigma x times z gives me 1, and sigma y acting on z gives me 1, because I can take summation operator, and I can put it here. So I get indeed the answer 2. It will be 2 divided by this. So it gives me an answer. I suppose I just measure sigma x plus sigma y weakly by making a very weak coupling, so that the shift in the measuring device is inside this uncertainty. I have a superposition by different possible shifts of plus 1 and minus 1, that superposition gives me a shift which is 2. So this is a new kind of quantum interference that says that when I go to the regime where I have weak shifts inside the quantum uncertainty of the measuring device, I get shifts that are completely different from any of the usual strong shifts which are just the eigenvalues. Once we understand that, we have a completely new quantum phenomena that we have never suspected. And I want to show you in the time that is left few beautiful new features of quantum mechanics that are discovered once we learn to think correctly about the quantum system, which is both pre- and post-selection. But before that, I want to give the answer to Einstein. Why does God play dice? God plays dice so that we can have a situation that this is time. We start with many quantum systems, all of them are described at the same state. But we find at some experiments in the present, they behave differently. We can explain the difference by saying that in fact, these particles at the present know not only what happened in the past, but also knows, by information coming back from the future, what's going to happen in the future. Now, when we say that these particles know what is happening in the future, we immediately run into the usual paradox that says, what happens to our free will? We can still do any experiment that we like in the future. How is it possible that the particle in the present knows already what I'm going to do in the future? The answer is that it knows it in a way that it can't tell me, because if I make a measurement, a weak measurement at the present, and I find the impossible answer is true, it could be due to two reasons. One reason is because it really was shifted by two because of the future, and one reason is simply it gave me the answer true by mistake. Because remember, the shift is much more than uncertainty, I can get the answer true by mistake. So I need, for consistency, to have two things. I need, first of all, that two positives are the same way can end up in different ways, so that I can make a post-selection for the future to be relevant. I also need that the measurement in the middle should have noise, as possible mistakes. So that if I do a measurement in the middle and get an impossible value, it could be due to two reasons. One is that it's a mistake, and the other reason is because something comes from the future. I don't know yet which of the two it is. But if I do in the future measurements and I post-select only the cases that I got the answer I'm interested in, then suddenly the things that were mistakes become necessary, because only those are kept and all the rest. And so the thing that looks like noise becomes meaningful when I know what is going to happen in the future. So God plays dice. It introduces uncertainties both in what happens to the particle in the future and both what happens to measuring devices. It says noise. Both these things are necessary in order for the future to be relevant for the present without violating causality or free will. This is very, very deep and important. Okay, now let me give you very quickly some beautiful examples of the. Yes. Yes.
I take a sample of, say, a million spins.
Yeah.
And I evolve them. I evolve them through the time, the starting time t1. I evolve them through the time t, and I weakly measure this.
Yeah. And I have n particles all started the sigma x equals to plus one.
Some of these two distributions, but I can't tell which of these spins is giving me the distribution on the right, which is giving me the distribution on the left.
Yeah.
The only way I can figure that is if I let them evolve to the final time, and then measure their spin in the y direction, and then I can use that information to separate the weak measurement out, and I will get those two values.
No, but the point is, the measuring device, you have already measured what happened to the measuring device. You find that it was shifted by two, okay? The measuring device, here it is. The measuring device has this distribution. It has a very small tail that goes all the way to infinity. You can find an answer here that will go to the position two, which is completely outside. You can find it due to two reasons. You can find it with the probability proportional to this to be a mistake, or you can find this if you do the post-selection. The probability for the post-selection is half to the power n. Extremely small compared to the probability to find this by mistake. Okay? So if I do the measurement and I find this thing very rarely, because this is also rare, I would say this is probably a mistake. But then I go and make the sigma y measurement, and I find that all the sigma y's were equal to plus one, then suddenly this mistake is false upon me. And in fact, I can do this measurement by n measuring device. Not the same number of particles, but say 10 measuring devices, 20 measuring devices. If each one of them can give me this answer by mistake, but there is no correlation between them, the first one gave me this mistake, there is no reason why the second one will give me this mistake. But if I postulate, and if I were lucky to find that all of them were sigma y equals to plus one, I come back to all these measurement devices and find that all of them have picked up exactly the same mistake. Okay? So it's only one of them that makes all the others, that force all the others. All the others behave completely like mistake. So that's the freedom I have, that the mistakes are give me complete noise, but if I pick up the particular situation, that all these noises are now becoming meaningful and give me the same answer. Any other question? Okay, let me give you very quickly some, because it's research, there is another talk. And I would like you all come to this talk because there will be a guy there that will try to tell us that Greek values are not interesting and they can be classically, they can be reproduced classically, and then at the end of this talk I will show to him why he's wrong. So it will be fun. You come and listen to it. Yes.
Yeah. What if, like, in the middle, when you're taking a measurement at the middle time, if you think about it, like, you're taking a measurement of 1 plus sigma y instead of sigma x plus sigma y?
No, I didn't say 1 plus sigma
y. Yeah, I mean, but if you take it as because you already know the value of sigma x, and what if in the middle you think
I said, if I look at sigma x plus sigma y, and I calculate its weak value, if I have an initial state psi and final state lambda, I call it, okay? Then the weak value is this divided by the scalar product of lambda times psi, right? This is the weak value. Now it says, I want to calculate this weak value. I say when sigma x equals to psi, it gives me 1 times psi. And when sigma y x on lambda, it gives me also 1. So the answer of this will be 2 lambda psi divided by lambda psi. So you get the answer 2. So the weak value of sigma x plus sigma y with this pre and post selection will give me the value 2. That's what I was saying.
So I get that, but with measuring at the middle time, right? I feel that you're already measuring sigma y at the middle time. You're collapsing it.
No, in the meantime, I measure sigma x plus sigma y, not sigma y alone.
Okay.
maybe you're talking about the proof that I gave that if I look at e to the I, GQ, times sigma x plus sigma y, and if this is sufficiently weak, I can write it as 1 plus I, GQ, times sigma x plus sigma y. Is that what you're talking about, this 1?
No. Y equals
to
1 will give you the value of
2,
right?
Oh, I'm saying, okay. I'm saying now I start with many particles. All of them started with sigma x equals to plus 1. I do on each one of them the weak measurements of sigma x plus sigma y. Okay? And then I post-select sigma y. And I now look at measuring devices, only those that are connected with the final result sigma y equals to plus 1. I discard all the others. And if I only look at those, I find that their pointers of the average shifted by the value 2. Because I discarded all the others. If I take all of them, I will find that the average was the normal average.
So how do you get any new information from that?
Huh?
How do you get any new information from the weak value when you are already post-selected and you know the value? Because you know the final value.
Yeah, but the point is that the median value was an impossible value. Sigma x plus sigma y as eigenvalues can only be square roots of 2. It can never be equal to 2. So the new thing is that because the particle has both properties of sigma x and sigma y, usually we say it has only one property. Because it has both properties, it can give you the impossible value that sigma x plus sigma y is equal to 2. It's an impossible value. And nevertheless, the measuring device shows us this value. How is it doing it? I'm trying to explain that this is due to interference. Interference between 1 and minus 1 can give you the answer 2. Because sigma x plus sigma y divided by square root of 2 has only two possible values, 1 and minus 1. So if I do a strong measurement, I will always get either 1 or minus 1. But if I do a weak measurement, I can get interference between moving to the right by 1 or moving to the left by 1. And this interference gives me a shift by 2. This is a new idea. So quantum interference of shift to the right and to the left gives you a bigger shift than the maximum shift to the right. This is due to interference phenomena. Yes.
Suppose I have n particles, and I take both of them through the middle, and I measure, I do a weak measurement. Now, I don't take them to the end yet, and I mean, I say I return a weak measurement of two, so I know it's either an error, or I know that
If you were studying the future to do a measurement of A, then you will find always the eigenvalues, and therefore you will know exactly that it will shift according to user rule. If I find it elsewhere, it must be a mistake.
Is there any possible way you could find out whether or not it was an error without?
No way, because if you could, you would violate causality or free will. No way. So the only reason why the future can intervene this way is in such a way that there would be absolutely no way by just looking at the results in the measurement to tell what will happen in the future. Otherwise, we wouldn't have free will, there will be no causality. So God is playing dice to introduce this noise in the middle so that it will allow you to infer that there was an effect of the future, provided that this thing happened. Okay? So things that look, I have N measurement, and I get mistake here, some mistake here, some mistake here, no connection between all those mistakes. But if I have the rare post-selection, suddenly all these mistakes are forced upon you. They are just the ones that are left there. So I put order. If I do the right thing in the future, I put order into the quantum noise of all this measurement. Yes?
When you were taking phi as a measuring device, so if we can do a calculation like this, wouldn't phi need to be a quantum?
Yeah, if I do the average over all post-selection, it will give me that usual quantum average.
What I'm saying is, does phi need to be a quantum mechanical device?
What?
I mean, if we can do this calculation, we can couple phi to our system, then does phi need to be a quantum mechanical system?
Can somebody tell me what the question? I don't hear it.
The measuring device, does it have to be a quantum mechanical system?
Right? Yeah.
Phi is of course a quantum mechanical. Every classical measuring device can still be described as a quantum system, as a limit where the uncertainties are playing very little relevance. But nevertheless, I can discuss, even for a classical device, a shift in the pointer that will be smaller than its uncertainty. Even classical pointers have necessarily some small uncertainty. Okay? Yes?
Is it necessarily true that I always get a real value for the weak?
I can't hear you well.
Are weak values always real?
No. And there is an interpretation of what weak values. If I look at a pointer, which is described by a Gaussian, so the pointer wave function for the momentum is e to the minus p q squared over, say, over 2 for simplicity. I Fourier transform it, and I see that the wave function in the, I guess this is 2 here. The wave function in the complementary variable is this one, okay? Now it turns out that if I find a weak value which is imaginary, instead of shifting this, it shifts this one. So there is an interpretation for complex weak values that the real part of it shifts the pointer and the imaginary part shifts the complementary to the pointer. That's also interesting. Now, very quickly, okay, what I will do, I will tell you, because we have only a few minutes, I will try to raise enough your appetite or your curiosity so that you will go and look at some of the articles that me and my group wrote in the last few years. So I will show to you how interesting those effects are, and I encourage you there to go and Google and look at under my name and see all the articles that have been published in the last 2 or 3 years. And I will show you now how interesting they are. So the first article is something that I called quantum Cheshire kit. Now, how many of you read Alice in Wonderland? Raise your hand. Many of you did not read it. Huh? Okay? So even for those of you who read it, those of you who did not read it, Alice in Wonderland is a beautiful book, was written by some English mathematician more about 200 years ago or even more. You know, it was Bourchier's position. Anyone knows? Anyhow, many years ago. Huh?
140 years ago.
Oh, good. Okay. It was written 140 years ago. And in this book, it describes all kinds of crazy things that happened to Alice in her dream. And one of the things is that she meets many elements, she talks to the animals, everything can happen. So she meets a cat, and it's called the Cheshire Cat because it came from a place in England called Cheshire. And she talks to the cat, and she makes the cat angry. So the cat decides to disappear. But it disappears in a very strange way. First, the tail of the cat disappears, then the body of the cat disappears, then the face of the cat disappears. The only thing that was left is the smile of the cat. Alice says to herself, I've seen many times a cat without a smile. But what could it mean, a smile without a cat? She couldn't understand it. I will show you how in quantum mechanics you can separate the smile from the cat. I will do it with the cat, although Schrödinger did experiment where he superposed dead cat and alive cat. I will do this. I will do it with the normal particle. And I will do the following thing. I will take a neutron, and you know the neutron is a magnetic moment. When I say I will do it, not in real life, it's a Gedanken experiment. So I have a neutron, and I can take the neutron this way or that way, like in the Mach-Zehnder experiment. And I will do a pre-selection and a post-selection of neutron. The neutron comes initially here, it goes through half its mirror. So part of it goes here and part of it goes here. And then I do a post-selection by another half-reflecting mirror, and I find, look only at the neutron that came here. Now I can arrange the pre-selection and the post-selection in such a way that I will show for sure, if I do a strong measurement, I will for sure find that the neutron moves here, never moves here. On the other hand, if I look at the magnetic field produced by the neutron, it will turn out that it's produced only from this branch and not from that branch. That means that I was able to separate the spin from the neutron. The neutron went here without a spin, and the spin of the neutron went here without the neutron. So this is indeed like separating the smile from the cat. What does it mean to have a spin of a neutron surviving another side without the neutron there? Okay? I encourage you to read this article. It's called Quantum Cheshire Cat. And you will see how, by pre and post selection, I can arrange that this situation really happened. Now, the next thing that is very recent, that has not come published yet, but it's still already on the net. Yes, you have a question? What? The experiment actually has been done. Yeah, it's going to be published in Nature Communication this month or next month. It was done by a group of people that work in Grenoble and in Austria. They use the quantum, a place where you have a quantum way to produce many, many neutrons, and they were able to do this experiment. Okay? Now, now the new thing which just came out is something that I called a quantum pigeonhole effect. How do you spell pigeon? P-I-G-O. P-I-G-O-N. Pigeon effect. Ah, pigeonhole. Hole is H-O-A-L-L. Yeah? A, huh?
H-O-L-E,
sorry. Hi. Quantum pigeonhole effect. Okay, what is the quantum pigeonhole effect? You know that there is a mathematical trivial theorem, absolutely trivial, that I don't know why it was given the name theorem. The theorem says that if you have a number of holes and you have more pigeons than holes, there must be some holes in which there will be more than one pigeon, right? For example, you have two holes and three pigeons. Obviously, one hole must have two pigeons if they have to all be in the same two holes. simplest statement than this could be, and still it was given many years ago, a beautiful mathematical theorem that's called the Pigeonhole Theorem. Now let me show you. Are we up to finish?
Yeah, the next speaker wants to come in.
Oh, the 3 o'clock?
No, the 3:30 talk. You're interested in another room, but I think there's another talk.
Oh, okay. So very quickly, just 1 minute, okay?
Yeah.
So I was able to show that in quantum mechanics, we can have 3 particles and 2 cavities, and the 3 particles are in the 2 cavities, and nevertheless, there is no cavity in which there is more than 1 particle. Okay? So this I call quantum pigeonhole effect, and I encourage you to read this. All these are games, new features of quantum mechanics, properties, when you learn to think in pre and post selection. There are many other things, but that's enough interest for you. Thank you very much.